The Craft Club Show 278. Hey, what's up, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by scientifictriathlon.com. I'm your host, Michael, and on today's episode, I interview Golo Röhrken. Golo is a medical doctor, sports scientist at the University of Cologne, and a triathlon coach. And I don't think he mentioned this in the interview, so I'll mention it now, because he is also a very good athlete, having finished the Ironman World Championships in Kona in 2018, I believe, in 8 hours 58 minutes, and being 20th in the super competitive men's 30 to 34 age group. And he was also the first age grouper overall in Ironman Hamburg in 2017, in a time of 8 hours 57 minutes. This interview is about a study he conducted, and this was the first ever randomized controlled trial comparing a polarized training intensity distribution with any other training intensity distribution in triathletes specifically. So the study is called 6 weeks of polarized versus moderate intensity distribution, a pilot intervention study, and there is a link in the show notes. It's an open access study, so you can read it in full. A quick ask, if you would have a minute, it would be amazing if you could leave a rating and a review for the podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts where it allows you to rate and review. It helps a ton. Every single review matters when it comes to finding, helping more people find the podcast and keep the show growing and sustainable by having more listeners find it. Now, a big thanks to our sponsors that do make the podcast possible. They are Roka, which is the world-leading manufacturer of wetsuits, trisuits, swimskins, goggles, high-performance eyewear, and prescription glasses and sunglasses. They have a large product range with, for example, their Maverick wetsuit lineup, their Viper swimskins, their Gen 2 Elite Aero trisuits, and these are all products that are designed from the ground up with a simple mission of making you as fast as possible on race day with all of the features and bells and whistles that I've talked about in many other episodes that are really, really extremely well-engineered products for fast race times, whether it's in the water or on the bike or whatever it is. But they also have the category of sunglasses and prescription glasses, and they are taking a bold new approach to this whole eyewear category with features and innovations like their ultra lightweight materials, the blue light blocking coating options, the Geico anti-slip technology, online vision tests so you can update your prescription from the comfort of your computer at home, and much, much more. Check out all that Roka has to offer on roka.com and get 20% off your order with the promo code that you can get on roka.com/TTS. And thank you to Zen8. Zen8 creates a swim trainer that can help you get more consistency in your swim training. If you, well, right now, live somewhere where pools are closed, then not having any option to swim is obviously not good. And rather than using stretch cords where you are standing in a position that does not mimic actual swimming, then laying down on the swim bench, especially considering that this particular swim bench has several features that allow you to really mimic swimming technique, like the instability element that forces you to activate your core, and the perfectly designed height so that you will be forced to work on high elbow catch, makes it a much, much more effective option than normal stretch cords that you would do standing and put a lot of strain for your hamstrings and posterior chain. But even in normal times, beyond the pandemic, a lot of athletes suffer from not having the time to get to the pool on that regular basis, because it just takes a lot of time with commuting and changing and all of that. So if you can just supplement those pool workouts that you do with a few extra shorter home-based workouts, they will help you get that much more consistency and swimming progress. And that's where the Zen8 swim trainer comes in. It's also not big and bulky because it's inflatable, so it can take literally almost zero space if you are not using it for a period of time. And the price point with our special discount code is similar to a pair of running shoes. Go to zen8swimtrainer.com/TTS to get 20% off your order of a swim trainer. Now, without any further ado, let's get into the interview with Golo Röhrken. Today's guest on that triathlon show is Golo Rerkan. Golo, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Michael. Thanks for having me.
It's a great pleasure. We will have an interesting discussion today about some research that you published and also some coaching and training applications. But before we do, can you just introduce yourself and your background to the audience?
Yeah, sure. Hi, my name is Golo. I'm a medical doctor and I also have a master in sports science. And I'm a triathlon and health coach. Yeah.
Perfect. And let's start with the paper that we have here in front of us. And it's called 6 weeks of polarized versus moderate intensity distribution, a pilot intervention study. And I was just telling you before we started recording here that to me, this was a very kind of important paper when it came out, because in all the polarized training research, I've always kind of had to try to have the caveat that, okay, but triathlon isn't the same as running and it's not the same as cycling. So we always have to wonder, is it directly applicable to triathlon? It is a different sport after all. And so your study is the first that has done that. So can you just discuss sort of the background, how you started to do it, why that research question came up, and so on?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you introduced that actually very perfectly, because the studies of the last decade in endurance sports show that a polarized pattern might be more beneficial compared to a more moderate approach. But the thing is that these patterns occur in classical endurance sports like rowing, cross-country skiing, cycling, and they show that a polarized approach might be more beneficial. But what we have to say, I think, firstly, is what is actually a polarized training distribution? And it describes how much training is done in different training zones. And when we take like the lactate threshold, for example, as a threshold, then we can say we have like three training zones. One, low intensity training that goes from like 50% of VO2 max to the first lactate rise. Then we have like this medium intensity training zone from the first lactate threshold to the second one. And then we have like the high intensity training zones above the second lactate threshold. And polarized training is that most training is done in low intensity training zones. And some sparks or some sessions are high intensity training, and you really miss out on the medium or the moderate intensity training sessions. And compared to that, is what most triathletes do is that they have like a moderate intensity distribution where you have like most intense sessions are in this moderate intensity zone, like sweet spot, threshold, tempo, or however you call it. And because for triathletes, like, their intervals have to be race specific, and like triathlon in general, the intensity is not like in the high intensity training area, or just some areas are. If you have like a sprint or something, then you might have some high intensity training zones, but most of the intensity is like paced and like in the moderate intensity zone, like threshold, for example, like in an Olympic distance triathlon.
Yeah, that's good to have that that you clarified the background of what is actually a polarized training distribution, because it's been a number of episodes since, for example, I interviewed Steven Seiler, who coined the term polarized training back in the day. So good to clear that up. And also one interesting thing that has come up more recently in research is this concept of a polarization index, which I think a couple of years back, maybe there was a paper about that, and you used that in your study to actually quantify, well, how polarized are these distributions or these intervention groups. and a lot of actually previous interventions, that polarization index paper found that they actually weren't really polarized, or there wasn't a very big difference between the control groups when they looked at it through that index formula. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's quite interesting that you are talking about that, because it's always important how you measure things, especially like in science. You always have to make something reliable, valid, and so when we look at training intensity distribution, it is classified as this polarized pattern with heart rate or with feel. That's quite important that you use like an internal signal that you measure. And so heart rate is validated and also feel is validated. Most studies from Steven Seiler that you were talking about earlier measured training intensity distribution with heart rate. And then there are different approaches how to do this with heart rate or with feeling. That you have like one method which is quite common is that you say this is a goal session approach, and thereby you just give every session a specific goal. For example, you do like an easy morning run. This is like low intensity session. Maybe you have some sprints at the end, but the goal of the session is like low intensity. Then you have like a high intensity session where you have like intervals on the track, for example, only 10 times for 400s. Then the whole session is high intensity. And maybe let's say the low intensity training session was like 1 hour and the high intensity training session was also 1 hour. Then we have a TID or a training intensity distribution of 50% low intensity, 50% high intensity. So we just take the whole session as one goal. And this is actually what Steven Seiler did in the first studies, where he just proclaimed like this 80-20, where you have like 80% of the sessions easy or low intense and 20% of the sessions high intense or very demanding. And actually, this became many people were just taking this approach and were just using, okay, now we do like 80-20, but using a complete different method to actually evaluate that. And to compare that, we have like a different method where we have like the time in zone approach, where we just take the complete the seconds that our heart rate monitors measures. And that have specific bins where we just allocate like the time in these bins. And then we can also say, okay, we have like specific areas of training intensity distribution. But this allocation is completely different than the goal session approach. And this underestimates the time that was actually done in the high intensity zones. For example, if we come back to like the low intensity run compared to the high intensity intervals, in the high intensity intervals, of course, we have specific training times in the low intensity zone. Not like the whole session is not high intensity. We don't go like 1 hour all out. We just have the intervals that are done in the high intensity area. But a lot of the time of the session, actually more than half of the session, is low intensity. And so then you have maybe like a training intensity distribution of 80-20 with just two sessions. But actually, if you use like a goal session approach, then it's like 50-50. So it's a complete different scenario here.
Yeah, yeah. And then you even have other methods like the modified session goal approach, where you just take, let's say you do 10 times 3 minute intervals on the run, you know, 1 hour run, and then you would be back at that, or that run would be like 50% high intensity and 50% low intensity, not based on heart rate or anything else other than the session prescription, essentially. So there are, and that's where a lot of this confusion comes from. You're right, like, you basically, the initial concept has been bastardized many times over, and like how we measure things is very important. Like, we can learn something from every study, but when we don't put it in the right context and are careful about interpretation based on how things were measured and how that compared to different studies, then that's when it becomes messy.
Yeah, absolutely. And there are also some studies from Steven Seiler where he used like the time and zone approach with his professional athletes, and maybe we will talk about professional athletes. And there, the training intensity distribution was something like 96% of low intensity training 1 to 2% of medium intensity training and 2 to 3% of high intensity training. And he even called it polarized.
Yeah. So let's discuss your study. Describe what you did there, the objective and then the methods, and I'll probably cut in with some follow-up questions here, but you can just go through it in a summary kind of way.
Okay, yeah, cool. Yeah, we did an intervention study with not professional athletes, but highly trained athletes, you can say. And we compared a moderate training intensity distribution to a polarized approach, what we talked earlier, and thereby we enrolled 15 participants, and we had 8 in the intervention group and 7 in the control group, and they were 30 to 35 years old, and they had 20 minutes best effort of 3.6 watts per kilogram. So they were good trained, I would say, and had running best times of 10K approximately around 40 minutes. And we had approximately 80% of all participants were male and 20% were women. And we did the intervention was in the control group. We had participants were doing mostly low intensity training, but 30% of the training sessions were in tempo, sweet spot, or threshold intervals. In running, they did 4x 1.6 kilometers in threshold tempo and 1 tempo run on the weekend. They did 1 critical swim speed swimming set, and they did 1 interval session on the bike, also in the sweet spot area, and 1 tempo ride on the weekend. So they had a lot of medium intensity training, approximately 30% in.
Sorry, 30%. Is it 30% in terms of, because I'm looking at the schedule here, and it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 sessions per week, including 1 brick session, so bike and run. So 5 or 6, depending on how you look at it. And then 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 low intensity. So in terms of sessions, it's almost 50%. But 30% there, you refer to the how did you measure that?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's time and zones.
Okay.
We use
with heart rate.
Yeah, with heart rate. That's correct.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So go on then and describe the intervention group then.
Yeah, in the intervention group, they most participants were mostly doing low intensity training also, but they had 1 high intensity session in every discipline. And for the high intensity sessions, we used the intermittent exercise sessions where you had 30 seconds on a specific wattage and 50 seconds off or rolling. And we use you can see this also in the studies from Ronnestad, that you have a very long duration of approximately 10 minutes, where you had this whole 30-15 concept. So we had 13 times 30-15, and yep. three sets of that in biking. In cycling, in running, we actually did 10 times 30, 15, and in swimming, we did 10 times 50 meters and 20 seconds off.
That actually is something to point out for listeners that may go and look at your paper later. If you just look at the figure 1, there is a mistake there.
There's because it typo. Says 3 times
10 times 200 meters, but it should be 3 times 10 times 50.
Yeah, that's correct. That's perfectly correct.
Yeah. All right. So what did the intensity distribution end up being in that intervention group?
We prescribed actually. That's something I want to talk about also in the discussions. We prescribed an intensity distribution in the in the intervention group of 92.08, and the completion was something completely different. And in the control group, we had 65, 35, 0. So like when we say low intensity, medium intensity, high intensity.
Yeah. So, and just again for listeners so that they can keep up, in the intervention group, it was 92% low intensity, 0% mm-hmm. moderate, and 8% high intensity was the prescription. So what did the results show then? When you analyzed the data, what did they actually do?
Yeah. I mean, the results were that on average, all participants in both group improved their performance in lactate threshold 1 and in their peak running performance. But there was no significant difference between the moderate intensity group and the polarized group.
Yeah. I'm just looking at that table here. So the improvements were 4.2% in running for both LT1 and LT2 in the intervention group. And on the bike, it was 7.4% and 4.5%. So actually, this leads into one question that I want to ask. So on the run, roughly 4% improvement in both threshold. On the bike, between 4.5 to 7.4% in the intervention group, in the polarized group. But in the control group, the run, you actually had a minus 1.1%, so a decrease in performance on LT1 mm-hmm. and 1.5% improvement in LT2. And on the bike, a decrease in performance by 2.2% for LT1 and 0.7% decrease for LT2. But obviously, the variance was quite big there because there was no statistically significant difference between the groups.
Yeah, that's right. That's also something that what we discussed prior to that, that I would like to do the study again with a bigger group sample, because or maybe let's start a little bit different. The problem with the study was that we had in both groups participants that improved dramatically, but we had quite a high dropout rate, and especially in the intervention group. Mm-hmm. And so the thing is that you coach, I coach, and science is key, but of course coaching is an art, and you always have to really assess like recovery, assessment of the athlete, how does it feel? And this was it's always demanding in studies to really do that. And I think that a polarized pattern induces like a higher stressor on the body. I think we can all agree on that high intensity training is quite demanding, can be quite stressful for the athlete. You can induce great adaptations. You can induce dramatically great adaptations, but you can also, and that's like the downside of it all, you can also induce like overtraining. You can also induce problems with like high intensity training. I mean, we all see that with athletes that only focus on the high intensity side, and maybe our program was a little bit too stressful, and maybe it would have been better if we would assess recovery via, for example, HRV or mood or something like that.
Yeah, but again, that in introduces even more complexity. So I understand why the setup was the way it was. Let's discuss what you mentioned there or alluded to. What was the actual executed training intensity distribution? Because you said that it was not what you prescribed. So what did it end up being?
Yeah, the training intensity distribution in the intervention group was 75 in the low intensity, 11% in the medium intensity range, and 13% in the high intensity range. Again, this is measured by heart rate. So you always have to say, okay, heart rate does need some time to get to the high intensity range. And we saw in some athletes that in the end, they weren't able to really go in the high heart rate zones. They were stuck in a very specific, like in the medium intensity range, and they were not really pushing it to the limit again. But also like 13% high intensity with a training intensity distribution is very, very demanding. And it's more when we see it in the scientific context, it's more like a block periodization of it. So it's quite a lot.
Yeah.
And actually most athletes were in the end doing too much maybe of a good thing.
Yeah, What was so the athletes, you talked about their fitness level in terms of their 10K running and their 20-minute bike power. Their volume was, throughout this intervention period, was pretty similar to what they were already used to doing before. But do you have any way of assessing whether they were they used to doing interval training regularly, or did you assess that in some way?
Yeah, we assessed that. I would say that 50% of the athletes were already doing like high intensity okay. interval trainings. But nevertheless, high intensity training is not high intensity training. You know, like the thing with high intensity training, and I think you agree on that, is that most people do not get into the right zone. They only say like, okay, let's do a high intensity training, and they do, for example, 5x1K with 5 minutes easy running in between, and they do not get into the right zones. They were just doing too much rest. They were not really pushing their body enough to stay into this hard but controlled state.
Yeah, so you asked me if I agree with this, and I mean that's a really interesting question. I think that, well, I mean, to go back to the heart rate question, I don't, as a coach, I would never prescribe a high intensity session by heart rate. So, I mean, here it's not necessarily prescribed by heart rate because you have the, or how did they prescribe the sessions? Was it basically best effort, like in the Rennestad studies mm-hmm. with those intervals?
Yeah, we use like the best effort or ESO effort yeah. approach, but nevertheless, nowadays, I would set them a heart rate maximum limit. Yeah. For example, you know, they start from what? They have like something like 120, 125% of FTP. They start their interval there. But when they see that their effort and their heart rate exceeds, for example, 94-95%, then I say, okay, reduce the effort just to stay into like this VO2 max area.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense to use it as a control mechanism. Yeah, I think that this, again, coming back to the different methods of assessing the training intensity distributions, if we look at it through simply like a modified session goal approach, then the polarized group did 92% low intensity, 8% high intensity, but with the heart rate method, they actually did what they ended up doing with that very prescription that resulted in 92.08 ended up being 75.11.13. So it's massively different. And it's not to say that one is better than the other, but if, again, context there mm-hmm. is king. Yeah, and then to come to the control group, so what they ended up executing, if you can summarize that as well to compare to the intervention group in terms of their executed TID.
Yeah, sure. Actually, I have to look it completely up. I know that they have like prescribed 65-35-0, and I think they were more... Do you have it in front of you?
Yeah, I have it. It's okay, 78-22 is what they ended up doing.
Okay, yeah. So they were not doing any high intensity stuff, right?
Yeah. So yeah. Basically, I mean, it looks like too much high intensity is too much high intensity. So that's what it looks like here anyway. So what sort of conclusions did you draw from this study, both as a scientist but also as a coach?
That's a good question, I think. I think, to sum it up, a polarized intensity distribution can work and also can work in triathletes, no doubt about that. It's always the individual you have to measure. And we had in the intervention group, if you look at the table with the results, with the individual results, we had some quite dramatic increases. I had actually one participant, it was a girl, and she's now flying. So a polarized training intensity distribution can work, no doubt about that. But you always have to measure individual responses. And the second question, the second one is that as a coach, always coach by success. Like when you see that somebody's improving, then continue your path. But when you see that he's just reporting, okay, I'm getting tired, maybe my mood is not that good, my heart rate is going up, my heart rate variability is going down, then adjust the program and always measure recovery. Do the basics right. That's what I would say, what I would conclude from the study.
Yeah, that's perfect. And where do you think this sits in terms of previous research, your results when you compare them to other intervention studies, even if they are not in triathletes, but what have they generally been showing? Does this agree with what has been shown previously?
Mm-hmm. That's also something I think is quite interesting, is that we have, like what we talked about earlier, is that most studies on a polarized approach are done in sports where a high VO2 max is race critical. So you have to hit very, very high numbers in the competition to just go like this effort. For example, like in cycling, you just have a very good hard tempo effort for a long time, but then you go on the climb and then you have like 10 to 12 minutes where it is very, very critical that you hit like these, don't know, 85 milliliter per minute per kilogram, and that you hit that and then you win the race. But it's completely different in triathlon, and that's quite important. So it's not like comparing apples with apples. And there are some studies that that have been evaluating polarized approaches versus moderate intensity distributions in triathletes. There are currently like three or four. One is from Sale Perez from 2019. And he also showed that a polarized training might be beneficial, but the results are not that solid. You need more studies. And then in the end, you need like an analysis of all these studies to just conclude what works and what do not works. But in the end, it's always like the individual, right?
Yeah, that's definitely the, for the coaches and athletes, that's the takeaway. Like, you shouldn't marry the method. You should just know what your goal is, and then use different methods, whatever methods you think might be beneficial to get to that end goal. For me and for us as a coaching group, actually, because we discussed this study a bit between the scientific triathlon coaches, and we kind of started discussing if this is a bit of a kind of a vote for a two-zone training model. So you have your low intensity training and then you have the rest, because what ended up happening was that both of these groups did a similar amount of training in the low intensity zone and they improved similarly. So basically what they did above LT1 didn't necessarily seem to matter so much. Of course, again, caveats, large individual differences, and some people in the intervention group maybe would have done better in the control group and vice versa. Mm-hmm. But that's something we discussed, whether a two-zone model is actually quite useful, in that you can control, well, okay, we need a certain amount of low intensity, but then the rest can be really, really individualized and there is no right or wrong there necessarily.
Yeah. Actually, what we did was a completely different approach than you did. We did, after that, we concluded that we need like a five-zone model, also the one that Steven Seiler used, where we just have like the low intensity zone in two zones, because we also concluded, and I did a post assessment of my data, and I just found that a lot of people actually that were overtraining, they were just doing a lot of the low intensity sessions exactly at their LT1 effort. Mm. And this is something completely different as when they are just doing like easy rolling. And this was one of the things I just would say, okay, we need maybe like more zones to really assess like this difference. And the other thing is that we just included like zone 5, which is like the upper limit hit zone, or like this maximum zone. And in the next study, I would like to say, okay, if you hit like this maximum effort, reduce your effort. You're not going to sustain that. And that's also what Steven Seiler is saying between the lines, and that he says, okay, what's more efficient? Is it more efficient to have like VO2 max intervals in this area of 88 to 94%? Or is it more efficient to just go like all out? And he concludes that like this submaximal or this very hard but controlled effort is more beneficial.
Yeah, no, that's true. He often talks about collecting minutes is having the term he uses, mm-hmm. not necessarily in papers, but in interviews. But that being said, it's completely understandable that he used the Randstad intervals because they were shown to be very effective in his work. But also the Seiler method there, or what he talks about with the slightly submaximal and controlling the effort a little bit more, even if you're at or above threshold, or above threshold specifically, that's mm-hmm. also something that a lot of coaches have talked about. I remember, and specifically the Norwegian national team cross country coach talked about that a lot, and many others have talked about that as well. Mm-hmm. So that, yeah, that would be interesting to see how that compares with the type of high intensity work that was done in this study.
Have you personally tried like this fast start intervals that's coming up now?
No, I haven't. I'm aware of it, but I haven't tried it or prescribed it, at least not that I can remember.
Okay. That's also quite an interesting approach to yeah. do these things, that yeah. we just have to really assess how much time we actually have above a percentage of VO2 max.
Yeah. I personally, from a coaching perspective, I'm kind of on a mission to find a minimal effective dose of high intensity training, and I do think it's important. But I've definitely in the last 1 or 2 years probably been reducing the amount of high intensity training that I give my athletes, and mm-hmm. Be a bit more strategic with it, and basically using it as a, well, kind of like you described it, like it can be a block periodization tool almost, where you do sure. it for 2 or 3 weeks, but then for a large part of the season, the training test distribution is more focused on the triathlon specific intensities, and the low intensity always as the big base of everything, of course.
Yeah, but that's also what I do, is that while with my athletes, I use a lot of block periodization for the HIIT interventions, and then come back to like the regular training.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So these next few questions are more so to you as a coach than related to the specific research. But do you even, when you plan your athlete's training, do you even think about, okay, I want my athlete to do a certain amount of percent of low volume or low intensity training or high intensity training? Or is that just a function of things like, well, if you have an athlete that trains 15 hours per week, then they're automatically going to have to do more low intensity training than somebody who does 5 hours per week. Mm-hmm. Like, how do you view training test distributions? Are they a prescription, or are they just a consequence of other constraints in the programming?
Mm-hmm. Actually, I find the training intensity distribution quite useful in working with my athletes, maybe also because of the background with the study. That I evaluated there some aspects, and that I like to see that. And I especially like to have like low intensity training in two zones. And when you say, of course, it's completely different to train an amateur than to train like a very successful athlete or even a professional. And if you have like a professional athlete, they will do very, very low percentage of high intensity training per se. I mean, they just have to do like the volume. They just have to be like consistent with their volume and do not overtrain. And for them, you have to be very, very careful to implement high intensity sessions for them. And for like an amateur on the other side, it can be useful to implement maybe a little bit more high intensity stuff because they are not training that much, and they maybe can fuel better also. Like, this is something that we have to consider for a professional athlete, that they do fuel right for their sessions and that they do not go into like an energy deficit or something. Also like in terms of overtraining, also in terms of injury, of stress fractures or whatever. And for an amateur athlete, it can be completely different. They might be even better with doing a little bit more like high intensity sessions. And then you have to conclude like the individual things, that if you have like an athlete that has maybe like a good VO2 max, but a very bad economy and a very high lactate, very high VLA max, of course, for them, it's detrimental to just say, okay, let's do like high intensity sessions, but because this will not make them faster at all. And I see this a lot in quite good amateur athletes that actually want to do like the step in the professional area, that they only focus on VO2 max. Maybe they have like a 70, 75 VO2 max, and they will just try to increase it to the 80s, no matter what, but their contribution and their consumption of carbohydrate is so high, they will never even finish an Ironman. So that's something, you know, you always have to take that into perspective.
Yeah. And then another question, when you prescribe moderate intensity sessions, do you have any preference, like what type of sessions do you like in that moderate intensity zone, so to say?
Yeah, I'm a big fan of race-specific intervals, especially on the bike, in the aero position, maybe like low cadence, 20 to 30 minute efforts. I start with tempo efforts there, maybe like, and then I also include some sweet spot threshold, some sweet spot sets also on the aero bars. That's something I really like. And on the run, I also like to do like some hill repeats in this tempo zone area. I like that. I do a lot with my athletes, especially for Ironman athletes.
Yeah. Finally, what do you think that listeners should take away from your study and in general from regarding training intensity distributions? What sort of, if you can give some key advice or tips or take home messages, what would that be?
Yeah, that's a very funny question. I would say that like the training intensity distribution is the cherry on the cake. And most people, I mean like 95% of the people, will do the basics wrong. And I absolutely love your podcast. Honestly, Michael, it's just one of the best podcasts out there, especially for triathlon coaches. And I just think that most people geek out too much about like the very fancy stuff and about like the next scientific method, which is nice. I mean, I'm a scientist. I love that. I love that idea. But in coaching, it's still an art. It's still something different. We are not machines, and you have to do like the basics right. And that's what most people do not really do. I have athletes that talk about high intensity sessions, polarized distributions, but they do not train consistently. And if they do not train consistently, we don't have to talk about the other stuff.
Yeah. You need to earn the privilege to talk about the other stuff. Absolutely. And I mean, you're right. And I like, actually, it's funny because just earlier this afternoon, I was recording a podcast, a Q&A episode. As you know, I'm doing Q&As weekly, but I have a problem with the Q&As that I'm actually not getting a lot of the basic questions. I'm getting a lot of the very specific niche questions, and it's almost getting to the point where I have to consider whether at what point do you draw the line? Like, is this even helpful for people, or is it more helpful to go back a bit more to the basics and repeat them a bit more often rather than keep answering new questions that are getting more and more complex, but not necessarily more and more helpful, you know?
Totally agree.
So then, I mean, I think that can probably be one of the answers to the next question. But looking looking at training test distributions anymore, just generally as a coach and as an athlete, what would be your top pieces of advice for athletes out there listening?
I think my top personal advice would be to always treat the individual, always have a holistic approach, always set health as your first priority. I mean, this is also from my medical background that I often see that people are not really healthy and then they are just getting into the sport and expect miracles. You have to have like this health background and then put performance on top of it. And then like you told me, like we talked about that earlier, that consistency is key would be like next thing. You have to always make sure that this is right. Then assess your recovery and set realistic goals. And the last one would then be train specifically for the event.
Perfect. I was going to ask you where people can find out more about you, but then I saw that, oh, I didn't ask my rapid fire questions yet. So let's move on to the rapid fire questions. And the first one here is, what's your favorite book, blog, or resource related to endurance sports?
Yeah, that's a good one. I like, for health reasons, I like the stuff from Inigo Samilan that you also had on the podcast. He's just an amazing figure for me. And from Peter Attia, I like also his stuff. I think he's also doing a great job there. For triathlon, I like the stuff from Alan Cousins and Dan Rang. I had the pleasure to do like some stuff with Dan the last for Bora Hansgrohe. We did the exercise testing. It was amazing. Just great coaching team.
Yeah.
And Principle from Ray Dalio is also a favorite of mine.
Right. And what's your favorite piece of gear or equipment?
I think the classical heart rate monitor and feeling.
And finally, what's a personal habit that's helped you achieve success?
Yeah, it's. I think it's getting up early. And the first thing in the morning is doing something for me, for like positive affirmation. This could be some sports. Going on a walk with my girlfriend, something like that. First thing in the morning, I get up, I do something for myself.
Okay, that's great. And now, finally, where can people find you and follow you, and whether it's as a researcher or as a coach?
Yeah, I work together with other coaches under the name of rocket-racing.com. You can find me and us there. Unfortunately, it's only in German, but you can just look on my Instagram. It's doc-golo. I think that's it.
Yep, I'll put the links to that in the episode description and the show notes so people can find it.
And we also have a podcast, that's right. Rocket Science, it's the podcast. It's a German podcast for health and endurance.
We do have a lot of German listeners, so I'm sure you'll get some new ones after this.
Oh, that's great. Great.
Okay. Cool. Well, thank you so much, Golo. It's been really nice talking to you and hearing more about your study and also the coaching applications of the study. I really appreciate people that wear both those hats, because I think that you can get so much out of combining the two and looking at it from both sides of the coin, so to say.
Thank you, Michael. I really appreciate that, and I really like your work. Your podcast is amazing, and I hope we stay in touch.
Yeah, that's it.
All right.
I hope you enjoyed that interview. I know a lot of people are really interested in the topic of what is the right, quote-unquote, training intensity distribution. So I wanted to add a short personal commentary on this topic here after the interview itself. And just for context, I am recording this a few weeks after actually having conducted the interview. So some of these things we probably already mentioned in the interview, and I hope I don't repeat things too much. But on the other hand, that would be good if I did, because it shows some consistency in my opinions. But to me, a key point here to mention is that training intensity distributions are descriptive and not really prescriptive. And by that, I mean they can tell you how you're training if you calculate your training intensity distribution, your TID for short, somehow. But you shouldn't look at like take a recipe and say, okay, this is exactly how I should distribute my percentages in the different zones. That would be a prescriptive way of using TIDs. And I don't think that is the correct way to use this particular thing at all. I think we can learn things from them, but we shouldn't see them as prescriptive. They're basically a consequence of many, many factors, like what is your training level right now, what are your strengths and weaknesses, what events are you training for, and so on. And by that said, we do gain a lot of useful information from studies like the one we discussed here with Golo, intervention studies, comparing one TID with another, and also from observational studies, like, for example, the original studies looking at different elite athletes and how they would typically train on a period of over a long period of time, like several seasons even. But although we can learn from all of these studies, again, you shouldn't just base your training on what or which TID you think is best. Your training should be based on what capacities you have right now and what capacities you need to have to achieve your goals in your target events. So it is highly specific to you and highly specific to the event, even though, of course, as you know, there are many, many overlapping factors and similarities across all endurance events. But that being said, there are also things that are different when comparing different sports. For example, comparing marathon runners with rowers that race in a race that lasts just over 6 minutes or so. So, and that is why we see differences in the TIDs when looking at different sports in an observational retrospective analysis. And also, we shouldn't forget that the individual differences in how much training load of a particular type you can handle is important. So in this study, for example, we saw that athletes that could manage 3 sessions of very high intensity per week for those 6 weeks of the study improved a lot, but not everybody could do that. So obviously, if you are an athlete that cannot handle that amount of high intensity load, then you shouldn't do that because it would be counterproductive. So you might either reduce the intensity or change the type of hard workouts, go to a more moderate intensity approach, or you could simply reduce the frequency of those highly intense workouts, but perhaps go from 3 per week to 2 per week, or the volume of them, or a number of different options that you have. And what that will lead to, depending on the changes you make, is potentially an entirely new TID. So again, don't marry the means, marry the outcome, if you want to put it that way. And finally, from a pure coaching perspective, I would say that a couple of things that are important to look out for would be, first, to make sure that you do enough of the aerobic training, so that low-intensity training. What enough is really highly depends on, of course, time availability, but also your goal events and your current ability and your training background. It does vary a lot, but just make sure that you do enough. And when you do this type of training, you can also think about the intensity that you do it at, and that also depends on a number of factors. So whether you do it at the higher end of low intensity or you just go really, really easy at the lower end, all of this depends on things like your ability to recover day to day, and also what your hard sessions of the week are like, how much training you do overall, what is your overall volume, and also what is your goal event. If you're training for an Ironman, then it might make sense to do quite a bit of your easier training kind of at the higher end, because that is quite specific to the race. But if you're training for sprint distance races, then that is not at all specific, so you might as well go really easy in those easy sessions, or the low intensity sessions too, because you're not going to move the needle in those for the purpose of race specificity anyway. So those are just generalizations. But another generalization is that it's always better to go a little bit too low than a little bit too high. So err on the side of caution if in doubt. The second thing I think is really important to look out for is that in terms of the harder training, specificity is really important, at least as you get closer to your goal races. Beyond that, you can do things like looking at your physiology, do specific metabolic testing, for example, to assess where your weaknesses are. But also, if that's not an option for you, it's not a bad strategy to simply do something very pragmatic. Farther away from races, you might work more on your weaknesses, and closer to your races, you might work more on your strengths. So, for example, if you're really strong at threshold type work, but you suck at short, hard intervals above threshold, maybe when you have many, many months to go until your races, you do 2 of those short, highly intense interval sessions for every one session that is more focused on your strengths, like your threshold if in this example. But then as you get closer and closer to the race-specific phase, the more you can switch towards first perhaps an even split between working on your strengths versus weaknesses, and then eventually maybe 2 sessions working on your strengths for every one session working on your weaknesses. And then in the last month or 2 or before the race, the key is to work on specificity as much as possible, regardless of if that is strengths and weaknesses, in my opinion. But basically, this approach of looking at what are your strengths and weaknesses and building towards more and more working on strengths later on has a lot to do with psychology, which is an aspect that I think we often really, really underestimate as athletes and coaches. When you play more and more to your strengths closer to your goal races, what happens is that you build confidence and belief in yourself and in your training. And that is something that is highly positive, and I think in many cases more positive than any minor incremental gain in physiological adaptation you might gain from really, really trying to optimize things physiologically that we might not even be entirely sure if that is an optimization in the first place. So I guess I'm rambling a little bit, but what I'm trying to say is there are many, many ways of doing things that actually do work. So it's easy to overcomplicate things and not focus on the big rocks, the things that are really, really important. So just keep in mind to try to focus on the big rocks, for example, basic training principles, and applying basic training principles to your context, maybe even harnessing the power of psychology. That can be easier and more effective than worrying about small levers and less important levers. For example, what is the exact percentage of my training that should be done in zone A, B, C, or so on. That is in no way a criticism of any studies on training tested distributions or any other field of sports science. But again, when it comes to training in tested distributions, just remember, they are descriptive and not prescriptive. Anyway, you can find the links in the show notes on scientifictriathlon.com to the study and also to some related episodes, interviews I've done on training tested distributions with recently Michael Rosenblatt and back in episode 177 with Steven Seiler, who we mentioned a lot in this episode as well. On Thursday, we have another Q&A coming out, and next Monday, I interview Helle Fredriksen, who many of you will know, as she's a former professional athlete, but she is now a coach. She's the world best female half distance record holder, so the female that has done the fastest half distance race in the history of time with a 3:55 something, I believe. So that's a really great accomplishment. Also an Olympian and world champion. So I look forward to seeing you then. In the meantime, if you want to take your training up a notch, then go and have a look at the coaching services and training plans we offer on scientifictriathlon.com. We would love to help you out and make your training as good and effective as possible. Finally, big thanks to our sponsors, Roka. Check out their wetsuits, trisuits, swimskins, goggles, high-performance eyewear, and prescription glasses and sunglasses, and get 20% off your order with a promo code that you can get on roka.com/TTS. And thank you to Sen8. Use the Sen8 swim trainer to improve your technique, power, and stamina, even when you don't have time to go to the pool or when pools are closed. And do that while practicing in a swim-specific position, laying down without putting strain through your hamstrings and posterior chain, and also practice things like good core activation and a great high elbow catch. Get 20% off your order on the swim trainer with a promo code that you can get on zen8swimtrainer.com/TTS. Thank you, as always, for listening. Keep training smart and keep loving triathlon.